Welcome to the podcast, Amazing Tales from Off and On Connecticut's Beaten Path. And I'm your host, Mike Allen. So it's true this is a podcast about Connecticut history, and today we're talking about Plymouth, Massachusetts, where the Mayflower boat landed, but there's a good reason why, and it turns out there's a connection between Connecticut and Plymouth Plantation, which we'll go into a little later on. Our guest today is going to explain what it was like for those intrepid pilgrims who arrived on the original Mayflower in 1620. He's Jack McLaughlin, and he's an interpreter on the Mayflower II Museum boat in Plymouth Harbor. It's an exact replica of the original Mayflower. He's going to be along with some of his incredible stories in just a moment. This week's trivia question. The 1,500 horses used by French General Rochambeau when his soldiers helped the Continental Army beat the British in the Revolutionary War had a problem. What was it that made it difficult for the horses to function as intended? We'll stick around after the main program for the answer, because then you'll know the topic for next week's show. Amazing Tales from Off and On Connecticut's Beaten Path is brought to you by our sponsor, Yale New Haven Health. Yale New Haven Hospital was the very first hospital in Connecticut. They opened their doors 200 years ago and later introduced the entire country to the use of penicillin and chemotherapy. Today, some of the brightest minds in medicine choose to work there, and it's the primary teaching hospital for the prestigious Yale School of Medicine. For more information, log on to ynhhs.org. That's ynhhs.org. Recently, my wife and I traveled to Plymouth, Massachusetts for the first time. We had heard about the Plymouth Plantation Museum, and that's where they recreated the housing and other conditions that the original Pilgrim settlers faced when they arrived in North America from England back in 1620. Well, it was truly amazing. One of the other highlights of the trip was boarding the replica of the original Mayflower boat, the Mayflower II. Now, it's staffed by a very knowledgeable and well-trained team of interpreters who can tell you what life was like aboard that boat. We have one of them joining us today, and wait until you hear the stories from Jack McLaughlin. Now, to set up this episode, you need to know a little bit about the background. There were religious separatists, as they were called in England. These were the pilgrims who were opposed to the king's Anglican church, and they were being persecuted. And as a result, they were forced to move away at first to the Netherlands. And this was very unsatisfactory for them. Their children were learning Dutch instead of English, and their whole culture was different. So when they heard about the opportunity to go to the New World, well, they took advantage of it, and they left the Netherlands to sail to North America to start a new life and practice their religion in freedom. They invested in a boat to take them there called the Speedwell. But as you'll hear, it never made it across. And the result? Well, those separatist pilgrims had to cram in with other pilgrims. These were the ones who were along for non-religious purposes. So in all, 102 passengers crammed on a ship that was not designed for that number. Well, the Mayflower, it turns out, would blow off course. They didn't hit their main target, ended up on Cape Cod, and that posed some legal concerns leading to the drafting of something called the Mayflower Compact. Now, these weren't the first Europeans or even the first English to arrive in the New World. The Dutch, under explorer Adrian Block, had set up a trading post near present-day Hartford on the Connecticut River, and in 1607, Captain John Smith had led some other Brits to Jamestown, Virginia. But now it's 13 years later, 1620, and the first group of English settlers to hit New England would be on their way. And the written history about this voyage is scant at best, but it's enough to know the fascinating story of the Mayflower, particularly when you hear it from interpreter Jack McLaughlin. Jack, I am so happy to have you on this podcast, having listened to some of your incredible stories standing on the Mayflower II, a boat that was built as a replica of the original Mayflower. There's just so much to go over. And I learned so much, and I'm so sad to say so late in life. I wish I'd known this years ago, but let's get into it and tell people what there is to know about Plymouth and the pilgrims coming there and all of this. I want to start with the actual purpose of the trip. Now, as you and I have discussed offline, when I went to grade school, The whole idea was it was about religious freedom, and people wanted to escape the Anglican Church and have their Puritan form of religion. And while that's true, and there were absolutely people on board who advocated for that, this was also a business deal, right? I mean, I think this is kind of underreported about the Plymouth Company and what they had done. I mean, it wasn't just like get on the boat and let's go. Somebody had to pay for all that, and they were expecting something in return. So could you tell us that side of the story?
Absolutely, Mike. Yeah, I mean, even when I was a kid, so I was born in 2000, and growing up, we were basically told the same thing. The pilgrims just wanted to go to America just because of religious freedom. And yeah, just like you said, that's true. But here's the thing. Only a third of the passengers on board the Mayflower in 1620 were actually the Separatists or the Reformists. The whole huge chunk of the journey was a business venture because the merchants in London and England, but there's about 70 of them, 70 of them, just hanging around and saying, we should probably get another colony, or we should probably invest in the colony like the people in Jamestown were doing. So let's get a group of people and let's just put them on a ship and send them out. And the Speedwell is the ship that's carrying the religious or the reformist pilgrims. And the Mayflower is carrying the people who are just going to America for the economic opportunity or for the business venture. So the pilgrims buy the Speedwell, and with the money that the venture merchants or the London merchants gave to them to establish the colony, some of the pilgrims, of course, the non-religious ones, they rent the Mayflower in London. The Speedwell is supposed to go with the Mayflower because you don't want everyone in one ship anyways. You know, that'd be dangerous or even very uncomfortable. They meet up and they say, all right, it's time for us to go to the new world. Is everyone ready? And the Mayflower crew and the Speedwell crew say, yep, we're all ready. And they sail out of Southampton. And suddenly, I mean, within a few days at least, the crew of the Speedwell starts to say, hey, we're leaking and we have to go back. So they turn around and they go back to another city called Dartmouth. And they basically stay there for a month. And once they repair the Speedwell in Dartmouth, they go back out again and they say, all right, take two. Now we're actually going to go to America now. They go out and the same exact thing happens again. And they turn around and coincidentally, they actually go into a city in England called Plymouth. So the original Plymouth. And that's where the Speedwell pilgrims realize that they have to condemn the Speedwell itself, and they have to jump on the Mayflower. No one's excited for it. No one's looking forward to it, but they know that they have to jump on. Everything is going to be really crammed in, and no one's going to be having a good time on board the ship. They've been delayed by at least 2 months because they're supposed to leave in early July. They end up leaving in September. And so realizing that their window of opportunity is closing and that they have to leave in, like literally in 1620 in order to pay off their debts so that they can actually be free in the new world. They rack up a huge debt from the Mayflower, and they also rack up a huge debt from getting some clothing, mainly food, gear, and other supplies that they're going to need for the journey across the Atlantic Ocean. The area that the pilgrims wanted to settle was essentially what is today is New York City. The merchants or the venture merchants, they said, just go into that area. And even though they didn't have a good relationship with the King of England at the time, King James I, King James I begrudgingly signs a treaty or a little land pact saying that, yes, the pilgrims and then, of course, the other people who want to go, they are allowed to settle the very far northern area of the land that is known as Virginia, because basically the Florida, Georgia, modern day borderline, all the way up to where modern day New York, Connecticut is, that was called Virginia. And anywhere from Connecticut all the way up to, I would say, New Brunswick, Canada, and even Nova Scotia was called New England. So they realize that they're not in the area that King James said that they're allowed to settle. So the pilgrims signed their own pact saying that, hey, we have to stick together until we pay off all of our debts and we have to establish a colony or a functioning colony in this area, even though we didn't necessarily end up really in the place that we wanted to be in. The pilgrims are expected just to really fish for cod and hunt for furs, but it's mostly fish that the merchants or the people back in London want, because dried up fish and salted fish will make a large amount of profit, because back then you had fishing areas in parts of the North Sea and other parts in the Atlantic that were being either overfished. They were fighting over fishing territories. But in the New World, the land was basically a blank check at that point. And anyone who was to show up, you can fish there. So they were expected just to go fishing. And really, that's how they're supposed to pay off their debts. The pilgrims just want their own little religious colony where they can be safe.
Okay, so they reluctantly pile everybody into one boat, the Mayflower, to make the journey over. And that could not have been very comfortable, not only from a physical point of view, but here you have religious advocates with people who are there really for the business side of things. So how did that go?
We don't exactly know. Governor William Bradford's book they wrote about 10 or 12 years after the Mayflower journey, called Of Plymouth Plantation. It's the only source or firsthand source of the Mayflower journey from pilgrims, as most of them couldn't read or write. But Bradford talks about a few things about the journey. I have a book that's like almost 400 pages. He only spends like 7 or 8 talking about the Mayflower. There's not a whole lot to go off of, but we know that it would have been very cramped and uncomfortable. The people would have been very seasick. We don't know exactly how one-for-one they'll be interacting with each other, but we like to think of it as, you know, since they're all in the same situation and they're not allowed to go basically anywhere else in the ship except for that one in-between deck where they'll have cargo crammed in usually, they're all going to be like, hey, we're in the same situation, so let's not try and kill each other now. We don't think there's any acts of rebellion or mutiny on board the ship. We don't think there's anything violent or strange like that happening. Everyone's just really sick, and they're just desperately waiting to get to America. At the same time, it's really cold, so everyone is, you know, all bundled up, and they need body warmth or body heat to stay alive, essentially.
What we also know is that the same number of people who left Plymouth, England, and arrived in Plymouth, Massachusetts, it was the same number, but not necessarily the same people. Can you explain that?
Exactly, yeah. So what happens is that when they arrive in Massachusetts, or the first place they spot land or they step onto the New World, is what is today's Provincetown at the very tip of Cape Cod. And a day before they spot land at Provincetown, a young passenger or pilgrim by the name of William Button, he was 13 years old when this happened. He unfortunately passes away due to an illness or a fever. So he's buried out at sea, and then next day later, they spot land. But halfway through the journey, we believe, Oceanus Hopkins is born.
Now, help me out on this, because my memory's a little bit fuzzy, and it may not have been the Mayflower voyage. It may have been a subsequent one involving pilgrims coming over to the new land. But I've heard a story where somebody fell overboard, and normally that would have been a prescription for death. They wouldn't turn around and get you. That was just it. But there happened to be a rope floating in the water, and he grabbed it, and he has some impressive credentials in terms of descendants who came from him. Is this the Mayflower story, or is this another one?
Yes, that is the Mayflower story. That is the story of John Howland. So John Howland, he is a 17, maybe 18-year-old indentured servant who is working for the Carver family. So John Carver, the father of the family, he is actually the first governor of the colony. Unfortunately, Carver will pass away in March or the spring of 1621, which will lead to William Bradford becoming governor. But anyways, John Howland, we don't know why he's up on the main deck of the ship. William Bradford, like I mentioned earlier in his papers, he briefly talks about this incident. That's the reason why we know about it. But John Howland, being a manservant, he could have been up there for two things. Either he was dumping out the chamber pots or basically the toilets, or he could have been up on the main deck as a volunteer to help with some of the sailing duties, because sometimes when storms got too bad, some of these sailors will call down for extra help from a few young men or a few volunteers that were willing to go on the main deck and help out with some of the labor or some of the work. Either way, he's up on the main deck, and he just falls off. Either he slips or the ship just kind of pitches and he falls off because he's not too balanced, or he's not holding on. Gust of wind or huge wave. Either way, he's in the water. And like you said, yeah, that's basically a death sentence back then, because back in those days in England, they didn't believe in teaching people how to swim. They thought that if you were to swim or submerge your body into cold water or just into water in general, you will get ill or you'll become sick. So he doesn't know how to swim. And in order for them to turn the ship around, they'll have to do a very extreme maneuver with the ship's tiller and rudder. And they would have to basically do that maneuver for half an hour straight. So it takes them half an hour to move the ship in a 180-degree turnaround. And the water is also freezing because this is happening in October. And there's a storm, and the Atlantic is very cold during the fall and winter. How does he survive? He's holding on to a rope called the halyard line. It's basically a rope that's tied or attached to the topsail. And it basically helps you take down or lift up sails or just do work on that part of the ship. But he's holding on to it, and the sailors notice that he goes overboard. So they haul him back up onto the main deck. They tell him to get back down to the in-between. And Howland is sick for about a week or two, but he survives. And he'll go on to become a very successful or prosperous landowner. He will have quite a few children with his wife. When John Howland passes away at the age of 76, 77 years old, he will have about 88 confirmed grandkids. Those grandkids also have kids, and the descendants go all the way from George W. Bush and George H.W. Bush are descendants, and even people like Theodore Roosevelt. And he had a brother named Henry Howland, and Henry Howland is a ancestor to Presidents Richard Nixon and Gerald Ford. And he had another brother show up. His name was Arthur Howland, and he is a distant relative to actually Winston Churchill, the World War II Prime Minister of the UK. So if Howland died, then we wouldn't have the Bush family or even quite a few of the Roosevelts. American history could have been changed right there if that 17, 18-year-old died on the Mayflower or died from going overboard. But by the grace of God, as the pilgrims would say back then, he was saved.
One of the points I really want to focus on is we spend so much time talking about the Declaration of Independence, the U.S. Constitution, royal charters that set up governance systems in Connecticut for almost 200 years. And I think that short shrift is sometimes paid to the Mayflower Compact, which some people refer to as the first real democratic governance document in what we would, you know, eventually come to know as U.S. history. Could you spend a little time talking about maybe what was in that document and why it was so important?
When they were signing the Mayflower Pact, they essentially had to say, yep, we're going to remain here until the debt is paid, and we're going to be observing just common English law. We're going to have maybe a little bit more of a liberal view on what we today is called, you know, like free speech. The Mayflower Compact was really in effect in the colony of Plymouth itself up until 1691. And that's when Governor Sir William Phipps arrives to Boston, and he says, the king in England, they no longer want to see Plymouth and Massachusetts Bay colony to be separate. So they basically merged in 1691 and it becomes the Dominion of Massachusetts. So the Mayflower Compact is essentially made obsolete when that happens. But still, yeah, it's the first significant piece of legislation that people in the New World signed, because it basically says, look, we're not going to allow this colony to go into chaos or to descend in fighting. You know, we're all going to be in this together, and we're all going to work together because we have no other option. You know, we have to survive, and we have to pay this debt off in order for us to be free, really.
And that leads perfectly into the discussion of what conditions were like when they arrived, which was simply barren land. They had to get off the ships, come inland, build houses. They had a lot of sick people on board. They had just been 2 months, which is, I think, hard for people to stop and really think about. Through violent storms, seasickness, horrible conditions, 2 months, they finally get there. Then they can't just go on land and go to a house because there are no houses. So what was it like?
Yeah, so they show up and it's completely barren. It's probably about like a foot or two of snow on the ground. Average temperatures back then will be ranging anywhere from, you know, probably the negatives into maybe like the early 20s or teens. And the winds going from anywhere from 30 to 50 mile per hour. It was very brutal. It was very, very cold and very cruel towards the pilgrims, because as they arrive, they think that they might have a small window of opportunity or a small chance to maybe forage or maybe farm some stuff. But no, they arrive in basically the dead of winter, and they realize that it's very barren. We can't just keep, you know, looking around for stuff on Cape Cod. So once they go around the hook or the arm of Cape Cod, they start to head north, and that's when they find Plymouth. They like Plymouth because it has a bunch of trees or overabundance of trees and timber, and it also has various sources of fresh water. And it also has a harborage or a bay that is very unfriendly towards foreign ships. So if they try to get invaded, then the bay will act as a natural defense barrier against those who want to come in. They realize that they land here at the wrong time, the worst time possible, and that's when about half of the colony passes away. So out of 102 people, only like 49 or 50 are going to make it, or are going to make it onto land in the spring of 1621. So you have to stay on board the ship for 4 months straight, just hanging around in the bay near Plymouth. And yeah, you're just, if you're a pilgrim, you're just going to be on the ship for 4 months straight, trying to survive that first winter. And there's barely any heat. There's no fires, really. There might be one fire, but it's very small. It's bad, but no, suffering causes them to bond together.
So they become the first British settlers to come to the New England part of the New World. They're it. Their first crop season wasn't all that good, and the Native Americans came to help them out. And what did they introduce to them that was the savior?
First of all, they taught the pilgrims how to properly fish. They learned how to basically cast these gigantic nets into the ocean. They learned the exact best fishing spots. And then, of course, the whole entire idea of planting in America was fairly different from planting back at home in England or in Europe. Because when you're laying down seeds for the harvest, they would do it later in the spring or almost like early summer. And Massachusetts or New England, you have to do it earlier. You have to do it in like late winter or early spring. The pilgrims also are taught how to use bone marrow from fish. The indigenous people, they'll essentially grab fish bones and they'll crush them up. And then they'll lay the powder around the crop circles or their crop fields. Then the bone marrow is a natural fertilizer.
No discussion of Plymouth would possibly be complete without the discussion of the first Thanksgiving. What do we know about that?
So the first Thanksgiving, it happens in early fall of 1621. The pilgrims, they are doing a small feast just to say, hey, you know, we are giving thanks for the fact that we still made it. We made it across on the ship. We made it in the New World to this extent that we can actually have a small feast for ourselves. About halfway through the feast, Squanto shows up, and he has a few scouts and a few young warriors with him. And essentially, Squanto and his men were not invited to the feast, but they show up with a couple of bodies of venison or of deer. And the pilgrims, they say, oh, that's fresh meat right there. So, hey, wait a second, you guys can actually hang out with us. And historians over the years have really inflated or romanticized the image of the pilgrims having the first Thanksgiving with the indigenous Wampanoag. But it was just a feast, and essentially they said, yeah, we're friends. We're friendly now. And that friendliness will start to go out of favor within the next like 18 or 19 years because of the Pequot War and further grievances. So it wasn't like anything insanely significant to them back then. But to us now, I mean, it means a lot because, of course, it was, you know, the first Thanksgiving.
The Plymouth Plantation managed to survive through some unbelievable other challenges, and then they got overshadowed by a larger landing to the north of them in what would come to be known as Boston. Yet it was settlers from the Plymouth Plantation who made their way to the confluence of the Connecticut and Farmington Rivers in today's town of Windsor, officially starting the first British settlement in what we today call Connecticut. That wraps up this episode of Amazing Tales from Off and On Connecticut's Beaten Path. Incidentally, that rope that young John Halland held onto after he fell overboard, well, it wasn't even supposed to be there. It was supposed to be tied up and secured on the main deck, and had it been, well, the Bush and Roosevelt families wouldn't have developed the way they did. I want to thank our guest for today's program, Jack McLaughlin, interpreter for the Mayflower 2 Museum in Plymouth, Massachusetts. The answer to this week's trivia question, the question was, the 15 horses used by French General Rochambeau when his soldiers helped the Continental Army beat the British in the Revolutionary War, had a problem. What was it that made it difficult for the horses to function as intended? Well, the answer is, they were North American horses. They only understood commands given in English, not French. And so Continental interpreters had to travel with Rochambeau's forces as they marched from Rhode Island to Virginia. Well, next week on Amazing Tales CT, we're going to have a look at not only what it was like with the horse language difficulties, but all the other incredible logistical hurdles as well. Amazing Tales from Off and On Connecticut's Beaten Path is a production of True North Associates, LLC. This is Mike Allen. Be safe, and please stay healthy.